soon we're gonna have a fever. We can't keep doing what we've been doing so long, but we can turn it around if we just come together.
Welcome to the Green Front. Once again, I am thrilled about today's guest. Fabulous lineup for you. You won't want to miss it. I'm going to have my favorite co-host and Republican and climate convert on, D.R. Tucker, for the first segment at least. We're going to be speaking with someone you probably know about. He's a fabulous commentator, columnist, E.J. Dionne Jr. He's written a book called Our Divided Political Heart, The Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. I cannot think of anything more timely, and he has lots of wisdom for us, and we need it not only to deal with the issues of the day, but specifically our interest, our focus will be on our environmental challenges, climate change being at the top of that. So E.J. Dionne is a columnist, if you don't know, for the Washington Post. He's a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, a professor at Georgetown University, also a regular guest on the big talk shows, Meet the Press, MSNBC, NPR, and we're very honored to have him joining us on the Green Front, as busy as he is promoting his much-needed welcome new book. Welcome to the Green Front.
Oh, it's great to be there, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
Well, if we ever needed voices of reason, it is right now, especially with just about 5 months to go before the election. It seems like it's a bunch of unruly children out there, and they cannot agree on anything, even on, you know, things that we can agree to disagree on, it seems. What prompted you to write this book right now?
Well, in some ways, you could say I was inspired by the Tea Party, and the book is obviously, for those who know my writing, very critical of the Tea Party's view of our history. But I thought they were right to say, let's go back to the beginning of our republic as part of an effort to figure out who we are. And where I disagree profoundly with the Tea Party is in their definition of who we are. Their emphasis in our history is on individual liberty as they see it and individualism. And I see them as embracing a radical kind of individualism, which I think is quite different from the American kind of individualism. I argue in the book that from the beginning, Americans have been torn by a deep but healthy tension between our love of individualism and our deep respect and affection for community. And that you see this from the very beginning, way back in Puritan times. I mean, Ronald Reagan loved to quote that famous John Winthrop speech where he talked about America as a shining city on a hill. But if you actually go back to the original Winthrop speech, Rush Limbaugh would see it as socialist. Here's Winthrop. We must delight in each other, make each other's conditions our own, rejoice together, mourn together, always having before our eyes our community as members of the same body. And I've enjoyed lately linking John Winthrop to Bruce Springsteen because he's got that great new song out, Wherever This Flag Is Flown, We Take Care of Our Own. Well, that's the same sentiment Winthrop expressed, and that's who I think we are as Americans. We do honor liberty, but we also honor our obligations to each other.
EJ, do you think it's fair to say that the Tea Party embraces sort of an alternative version of history? And I'm thinking specifically in terms of the Christian writer David Barton, who's very controversial for arguing that the United States was, in essence, founded on the Bible as opposed to the Constitution. Do you think it's sort of like, you know, an invented past leading to an invented present leading to an invented future?
That's a nice way to put it. See, I think the problem is that on a lot of these matters, there is certainly truth to the fact that the biblical tradition was one element in among a series of ideas at the founding, and John Winthrop certainly speaks to that. But there was also a strong Enlightenment and small r Republican tradition that emphasized liberty as involving governing ourselves together, not just with an eye toward serving our own interests, but also with serving the common good. I like to point out the first word of the Constitution is not I, but we, as in we the people. And then there were several strands of individualism. Robert Bella wrote about this brilliantly years ago in his book, Habits of the Heart. There's a kind of Ben Franklin individualism that's mostly about self-improvement and a sort of Walt Whitman self-realization kind of individualism. These are all part of our story. So if, you know, folks on the Christian right want to argue that biblical ideas are very much part of our tradition, I don't disagree with that at all. If they want to argue that the founding was based on a theocratic version of government or on Christian ideas alone, I think they're mistaken. And that's where I think we need to sort of be honest about our origins. And we, this is making us much less interesting and complex as a people. We're a complicated people. We should be proud of that.
So we're more divided than ever, and extremism has gone to down to a level that is it's disturbing. At times it's humorous, but it's really quite serious when you consider the consequences of continuing to ignore the major issues of the day. And I'm going to take a turn into the green lane right here.
Please.
You mentioned the Christian right. Well, if you believe in creationism, look what we're destroying, and not even acknowledging that we're doing that or that there's even a problem in some circles. And I'm talking about the Tea Partiers, 30 of whom were voted into Congress in 2010, none of whom believe in, quote, believe in climate change.
Right, and I do think we have a real problem right now in agreeing on what the facts are, and that to treat climate change deniers as having equal legitimacy in terms of the science as those who argue there is such a thing as human-caused climate change, that's just misleading the public. You had my friends Tom Mann and Norm Ornstein on a couple weeks ago.
Tom Mann, yes, we're waiting for Norm Ornstein.
You had Tom on, and you know, they make the point that we have a very flawed debate right now because things that aren't facts get admitted into the argument. But again, it's interesting you go back to this biblical tradition. I'm sure you've had some of these folks on. There are Christians who devoutly believe that our obligation is to stewardship of the earth.
Absolutely.
And who are very involved in the battle against to do something about climate change, people like Rich Cizik. And again, I think traditions can point us in different directions, and I think that some of our friends on the Christian right have really, I think, done some violence to the Christian tradition, which is not at heart a radically individualistic tradition. On the contrary, it calls on us to care a great deal about each other, again, to go back to John Winthrop, to see ourselves as part of each other. And so, yes, I you know, the bottom line is I think there is a terrible problem in our debate with our unwillingness to face certain facts and then argue about what to do about them.
Well, most recently we had Dr. Catherine Hayhoe on, a religious woman. I think she's evangelical, and she is very much a proponent of climate science. She is a climate scientist, an atmospheric scientist. She, of course, wrote the chapter that Newt Gingrich had excised out of his book on climate change. And, you know, she really is I love those kinds of interviews when you're talking to people who are not the usual suspects and sort of outside the box in terms of being stereotyped. And those are the most compelling voices, which is why I was so excited to meet D.R. Tucker after reading about his climate conversion as a former conservative Republican who actually read the science and said, oh, my goodness, we've been duped, only to find his fellow Republicans and libertarian friends continuing to spew the same nonsense, specifically that they somehow presume to know more than 98%+ of the world's top climate scientists. That on its face is absurd, or that any conservative talk show host might know more than experts in their field.
And this is a horrible turn within conservatism and within the Republican Party. I mean, the word conservation and the word conservative has the same roots. There have long been genuine conservative environmentalists, and there have long been ardent Republican environmentalists. You don't even have to go all the way back to Teddy Roosevelt, who plays an important role in my book. The first President Bush, one can have disagreements here or there with him on these issues, but he appointed a very strong EPA administrator in Bill Riley. And, you know, this is somehow the right has sort of walked away from a series of legacies that it has that it ought to be proud of, and it seems to want to pretend it never had. And I think it's a great tragedy in our politics.
But EJ, who do you think is the main driver of this sort of turn towards the illogical on the right? I think back to some of the debates I had with some of my now former friends about the rise of the late Andrew Breitbart on the right and my issues with him. I basically saw him as somebody who didn't have any grounding in conservative tradition or history, seemed to have no idea who Russell Kirk or Whitaker Chambers or Norman Podoritz or Irving Kristol or James Burnham was, seemed to have no real connection to conservatism. He just seemed to hate Democrats and hate taxes and just seemed to go off on that. And he just struck me as being basically of inferior stock to the William F. Bucklands of the world. Did you see Breitbart as the main driver of this, or do you think there were other forces or other financiers, what have you, that led the right to this illogical path?
Well, I think there were more than him, and obviously he's no longer with us. I think that what you've had is, first of all, I don't think we can deny the importance of certain kinds of right-wing money in this. And, you know, the Koch brothers are the most famous, but there's been a lot of conservative money and some corporate money behind some of this push, particularly on environmental issues. I also think there was a kind of movement decision made at the end of the Bush administration where a lot of conservatives either came to believe themselves that the Bush administration had broadly been a failure, I think largely because of more than anything because of the commitment in Iraq, but there were other problems as well. But they couldn't declare that Bush had failed because he was too conservative. So they decided to declare that he had failed because he was a big government Republican, never mind that most of the big government was in Iraq and Afghanistan. And so for kind of reasons that combine some vague principle about being for small government, they also turned on the prescription drug benefit, although they'll never repeal it. They turned on No Child Left Behind because it was too much use of federal power. And they argued that the whole experiment in compassionate conservatism was wrong, not because of the conservative part, but because of the compassionate part. And the other thing is, I think you've had a defection of more moderate and moderate conservative voters outside, away from the Republican Party, so that you have primaries like the one you recently had in Indiana, where, you know, Richard Lugar had a conservative rating from one of the major conservative organizations of 77%. That's more than three quarters to the right. And yet he wasn't seen as conservative enough and was defeated by an opponent who said, I'm going to be against all compromise unless it gives us everything we want. That's a really different kind of conservatism. So I think there is something within the grassroots of the right, and it's not just the creation of Fox News or other media, and it's not just the creation of conservative money, although I do think money and, God help us, the effects of Citizens United are quite dangerous to our politics.
EJ, today is voting day in California, the primary here. Do you think that this extreme conservative movement is going to see a backlash starting, you know, with the primaries wrapping up going into the November election?
I think it will eventually, and I think the question is, does it happen sooner rather than later? I think it would be, I think the backlash would already be with us if President Obama weren't presiding over a very, very difficult economy. And I think that there are voters who would be inclined, middle-of-the-road voters, who would be very much inclined on issue after issue to reject this, as I call them in the book, radically individualistic right, but who may be tempted to vote the other way just out of protest against current conditions. So that I think the I believe devoutly, and I think the data are on my side on this, that we are not a right-wing country. Their agenda is not the direction most Americans want to go in. And so I think ultimately they will face a comeuppance. The question is, will it happen this year or will it happen later?
Of course, the problem is that the Republicans have decided to respond to this by sort of tightening voting ability and basically making it harder for people to vote, and also having personalities like Jonah Goldberg imply that younger people ought not to vote. What do you make of this sort of odd movement in terms of saying that if people don't vote Republican, they really shouldn't be voting at all?
It is. I know Jonah, and I do find it an odd argument. I don't think he would have felt that way during the Reagan era, when the young people were actually much more conservative than they are today. I imagine he would have seen them as forward-looking, which is how I look at them right now. I think these efforts to curb access to the ballot box are really pernicious. And, you know, when I look at Wisconsin today, you know, as a general rule, I don't think recalls and impeachments are the ideal way to deal with an incumbent you oppose. Normally, fixed terms give us a chance to throw people out eventually. I think why the reason why Governor Walker faces a recall, and it's a legitimate call for a recall, is that he was trying to, he and his legislature were altering the rules of the game in a way designed to strengthen their hold on power. So they were using power in a way to rig the system, not only with all of the voter, as I see them, voter suppression laws they enacted, but also the attack on unions is an attack, and some conservatives in Wisconsin have been saying this, on the organizations that have been one of the strongest parts of the progressive and Democratic constituency. And again, this is not the first time in our history that people have tried to control the ballot box. African Americans were denied access to the ballot in the South for decades, and that's why we had the Voting Rights Act. And these laws seem a regression from what we achieved through the Voting Rights Act and the litigation around it since. So I think it is very pernicious what's going on. I think, on the contrary, the government should make it easier for people to vote. I'm actually sympathetic to the Australian system where there is an obligation to show up at the polls. You don't have to vote if you don't want to. But I think that would put the burden on government to say, let's get everybody registered, people will show up, and we will decide, all of us, and be done with these efforts to suppress voters.
Well, I think what is most pernicious is the suppression of, you know, scientific evidence about what's going on, not just with climate change, but with our oceans, with biodiversity. On every level across the ecological spectrum, we are going in the wrong direction as population and consumption, you know, growth occurs. And we're really, as Al Gore said years ago, we're on a collision course with ourselves, and that was some years ago, and the best climate scientists, including and especially Dr. James Hansen, say we have just a matter of a few years to turn this around. And they've been saying that for a few years, by the way. So politics aside for a minute, do you think we can reach a consensus on just the issues regarding our environment, our climate, you know, in order to debate them? I mean, an intelligent debate, not a childish debate that just devolves into name-calling and, you know, almost it's almost like a slap fest. And that might be entertaining or a little troublesome, annoying. The pendulum does swing back and forth politically, but we have trends going on ecologically that are perhaps irreversible, that have consequences quite serious for future generations and, you know, not too far off into the future.
Well, as you know as well as anyone, it is, I think, much easier for the side that opposes environmental protection of all kind, including action on climate change, to say, well, we can't really do this in the middle of an economic downturn. So that, I think, is a sort of large fact that's pushing against this movement, whether it should or not. I just think that's a fact. But I, you know, what seems unfortunate about it is, as recently as 5 years ago, we actually had a consensus, some kind of consensus across the parties and across the ideological spectrum that we needed to do something about climate. John McCain and Barack Obama were both committed in the 2008 campaign to doing something about this. Cap and trade was an attempt to have a market-oriented solution that would take some carbon out of the atmosphere. It's at its heart a fairly conservative idea, and now we've moved so far along. The right has moved so far to the right that it now rejects even market-oriented solutions designed to solve this problem. And so it is a big setback. My favorite line on the United States that I repeat all the time is Winston Churchill's line that Americans always do the right thing after first exhausting all of the other possibilities. And when you look back at us, I mean, I think back to when I was a kid at the rivers that were just totally unswimmable, unusable, the fish were dead. We passed some serious environmental laws in the 60s and 70s. Critics of those laws said they would tank the economy. Well, they didn't tank the economy. Our economy is bigger than ever. And there are rivers now that are clean that used to be dirty. And the same is true of air in many of our cities. So that it seems to me that people who are environmentalists have history on their side in two senses. One is the gloomy doomsayers who said acting on the environment will kill the economy were proven wrong time after time. And eventually Americans act on the side of the environment. We've done it since Teddy Roosevelt's time, and we made a lot of progress in those years. So I'm optimistic for the long run. I think we have a lot of fights between now and then, and we have to hasten the arrival of that long run.
Any thoughts on Jonathan Adler's recent piece in The Atlantic of endorsing the fee and dividend model to combat climate change? It seems to have gotten a lot of traction, especially considering Adler's track record being a member of the what I call the ExxonMobil Enterprise Institute, the Competitive Enterprise Institute.
I confess I did not read that piece, and I try not to comment on pieces I haven't read. It seems like a good policy. If you explained it to me a little, I might get it and have a view on it, but did not read the piece.
Let's save that for next time, just because we have about a minute or two left, and I just want to ask you, what you think of this concept. DR and I have been talking about the need for a green tea party that would be neither red nor blue. For those of us who are steamed that they're playing politics with our planet and funding it as well, and given that we've just hit, I think, 400 parts per million in the Arctic of greenhouse gases out there, given that we're seeing more extreme weather recorded every month in every shape and form, and more Americans are beginning to connect the green dots, do you think we need something like that to, at least in the environmental arena, just break through this static and this noise and this garbage and really get more Americans' attention on the urgent need to address, the mother of all eco challenges, which has been, accurately called that, and that, of course, is climate change, because that has, not only feedback loop effect, but, the shelf life for, carbon in the atmosphere is very long. So even if we all got on board and did everything we could tomorrow, we're still going to have problems. But if we don't start turning the ship now with good approaches like fees and dividends, I don't know what hope there is. And I just wondered about your thoughts now that we have about a minute and a half left.
The core argument of my book is that we have this long tradition of balancing individualism and community, government action and market action, and that when we keep these in balance, we are at our best. I really think that the defection from this long consensus has taken place on the right end of the spectrum. And I do think that, two things need to happen. The radically individualistic right, or the radical right, needs to be defeated. But I also think that those people on the other side, both in the Republican Party, but also in the conservative movement more generally, who are not climate deniers, who do believe that environmentalism is part of their tradition, I think people on that side really need to get active and get some hope again. Because as long as you have a conservative movement that is as committed on ideological grounds to fight every bit of progress on these fronts, and this is, after all, a common good. This is not something that can be instantly translated into dollars and cents in your or my pocket, but it is about the environment, which is a common good. I think you need that side to re-embrace the idea of the common good again. So I think there's some work, and your co-host, who knows the conservative the conservative past as well as anyone, could probably be very persuasive with at least some of his friends on the right. I admired that reference to Russell Kirk.
And that's why I love having DR on, not only on the show, but as a partner perhaps in some kind of green tea party, if we can get it off the ground before the election. Basically, it would say, red or blue, please do not vote for any candidates in any office, from local to national to, don't let anyone near the White House who doesn't understand our green challenges.
It's sort of red and blue for green.
Exactly. And Mitt Romney, who used to believe that climate change was a real threat, anyone who would flip-flop on something that important, I don't think should be leading this land, and try to get people to make those connections, especially as we have a very close race. And if I have a Republican counterpart, as a co-founder of this party, I think that should get some, the right amount of attention.
Right. I mean, I'm skeptical about third parties. I have a lot of hope in movements outside of our immediate politics, because a lot of change comes through those movements.
And we're not actually talking about starting a third political party. It's more of an information campaign, an educational outreach, kind of an emperor has no clothes moment is what I see happening. And it seems like a teachable moment to, regardless of our differences, which are getting more and more extreme, let's take time out and look at the common good. Look at the fact that our life support system is under extreme pressure, and we need to all have, play a role in, if not addressing it, depending on our circumstances, at least understanding that it's real, and stop the ridiculous, quote, debate when there is really none. That's it. It would just refocus attention on that this is not just another issue of the day. It's sort of the one that makes all other issues possible.
Indeed. And again, I think, I wrote a book that talks a lot about American history. And one of the reasons I do is because I think, broadly speaking, ours is a progressive history. And you've seen on the environment, you've seen on women's rights, you've seen it on civil rights, and that it's time that we sort of take our history back from a group of conservatives who, and as I say, I'm glad they started the fight about history, but we should fight for an accurate version of American history, which I think is on the side of reason, balance, and progress.
Hear, hear. And we are now out of time. But thank you so much for joining us on the Green Front. Of course, D.R. Tucker, thanks for making this interview possible. We've been speaking with E.J. Dionne Jr. Pick up his book. It's called Our Divided Political Heart and the Battle for the American Idea in an Age of Discontent. Very important, very timely read. And we'll be looking for your columns in the Washington Post. Thanks so much for being with us today.
There's no reason anybody's got to take a fall. On the wall, and we can turn it around if we just come.